I thought what we'd do is do the informational stuff first, and then be able to spend the rest of the meeting just working on the action plan, having our work session. So let's start with the, I asked Nancy to give us just a brief overview of what's going on right now with Indigent Defense Services, because they are doing some things right now, so everybody's aware of them when we're working on our plan. So Nancy, I'll turn it over to you.
All right, so the Office of Public Defense Services is in the process of launching a pilot program to reduce dependency caseloads. We have posted a position for Deputy General Counsel. We did first round interviews on Tuesday, and we will have, of this week, we will have a second round of interviews next week, and hope to have that selection completed then next week. We are working closely with DOJ, or will be, and DHS and OJD to select a pilot county or two, hopefully two. Ideally, we'd like to do three, but I think our funding will limit us to two. So we've been comparing data points, data that we've collected from OJD and DHS, things like length of stay, time to jurisdictional hearing, time to disposition at permanency, and we're also looking at our attorneys, the best guess we can make about our attorneys' caseloads based on the survey that we sent out and the new petitions that are being filed in each jurisdiction. It's a little hard with some of the e-court implementations. We don't have all of the jurisdictions because as they make that switch, some of the data isn't available, but it will be, and so we're very excited and continuing to move forward.
And this is based on the Washington model that we've heard so much about.
Right. This is based on the Washington model that we heard about. Our program will include children as well as parents. So it will be different. It will be built to fit Oregon's model.
Anybody have any questions for Nancy? Thank you. And then we'll go to the report on the 2014 legislative session. And which one of you wants to?
You can go, and I'll just let folks know first that I did provide you with a summary of the two bills that were priority bills for us in judicial related to juvenile, House Bill 4156A, which I'm sure Lois might add some information on, as well as Senate Bill 1536. And these were both passed and are effective, and the effective dates are there.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could, I would like to start off by letting you know how we wound up in hearing room F, which came as a surprise to me until I walked into the office this morning. as you know, we accommodated the facilities by moving out of 343 upstairs to hearing room C. And I guess late last night, the sound equipment, mobile sound equipment, they have a couple of units, are all broken. So they could not have recorded this meeting had we been in hearing room C. Now, the room itself has recording as a committee room. It doesn't have recording as a conference room. So I guess the decision was made last night to move us here. So that's why we are here, and that's why there is no conference table here. I found that out this morning, and I've been trying to get to find out the reasons why. As for the February session, as a general comment, it was, I guess from my viewpoint, a bit of a frustrating session because there were a tremendous number of big policy bills, and most of them didn't pass. And that's probably given the nature of the session. Leola has already mentioned the two bills. I did staff one of them, and that was Senate Bill 1536. I think everyone's pretty much familiar with that bill. Other bills that did not pass that were somewhat connected to this area, including Senate Bill 4088, modifies the crime of criminal mistreatment to include sexual contact with dependent persons. It was a bill that came in session, caught some people by surprise, and I believe the Department of Justice and others will be working on this issue. Other bill that passed was one bill relating to employees unknowingly or unintentionally selling alcohol to minors while operating a store checkout device, and the discussion around that was that with these checkout devices, sometimes it's not as easy to check on ages, and the penalty for doing that is someone loses their ability to sell alcohol. Senate Bill 4114 authorizes court to appoint volunteers to serve as protected persons, special advocates, direct court to establish qualifications of the person serving as an advocate, etc. That bill did pass. I didn't staff it. I guess I staffed the bill. It had a lower chance of success. And then relating to possession of alcohol by persons under 21, and this bill basically... I believe it's a bill that basically says that if you report someone has been drinking too much, you're not held civilly or criminally liable. So it's a Good Samaritan bill. Mm-hmm. And it's intended to address a situation where kids are at a party, one gets deathly sick from alcohol or drug, or alcohol in particular, and then they bring them to the emergency room, and then they're all arrested. So that's pretty much it. We have an active session as it relates to work groups. Well, I've just got through putting them together. What may be of interest to this group would be the sex offender registration for juveniles. We are one of 13 states that requires all juveniles to register as sex offenders, and it can last a lifetime. We made some changes a couple years ago to that statute and made it easier for them to get off the list, but as you probably know, those of you particularly who are in the juvenile court, is that many of these kids don't qualify because they didn't commit just one offense. They may be in court for the first time. Oftentimes it's a familial situation, and they've got four or five offenses against them, and they're on the registration for life. It's an issue that cuts across both the conservative and liberal. It will be looked at. I know the Youth Rights and Justice. I know them as another name. I know they're actively pushing the bill, and I think it has, at least the discussion and getting into the issue, has bipartisan support right now. Also, the criminal defense lawyers and the DAs for about 2 years have been working on the expunction statute, the set-aside statute. I looked at the statute, and I think it's been amended 27 times since 1971. One of the problems of that area, and this would impact some of your clients too, is that most people who go before the courts go pro se. And most lawyers can't understand the statute, let alone someone who's going pro se. Some of the DAs do, and some of the defense bar does, so we've asked them to clean up the statute. They told me they'll be back with a draft sometime before next January. Of interest to this committee will be for pre-session filing of drafts. The drafts has to be in by September 21, which is earlier than we used to have it. It's because of the annual sessions and the different timeline. My suggestion would be that if you have anything that you feel that ought to be legislation, I would get it in a lot sooner than that. A request that's put in now, you will see before September. A request that's put in September, you will see in December. And I have yet to see any complicated legislation that's gotten right the first time out. I've had bills that I worked on that have been passed in June and found unconstitutional in September. So there are no Beethovens or Mozarts in this business.
Can I ask a question about that? So if there is a bill or a concept that we want to put forward, mm-hmm. Does that come from this group? Do we need to find there obviously isn't a legislator on this group. Do we need to find a legislator to support that? What do you think?
I don't think, I have to go back and read the statute again as it relates to committee, but I don't think we have the right to file legislation. But that's no problem. You could get it filed by either the House or Senate Judiciary Committee. I can talk to the chairs, and they're very accommodating in this process, okay? Particularly as it relates to the odd year session. There's no limit in bills. I've already filed 25 bills, okay? And I call them dummy bills and dummy bill. They're bills with broad relating clauses. I get calls every session as to why are we changing the cheating statute. I didn't even know it was a crime to cheat, as a couple of them have said. So it's because you can change one word in it. So that we try, for every rule, we try to figure out an accommodation. Okay? So the main thing, it's a logistical issue. It's not an issue of the ability to get a bill in. It's an issue of logistics, and timing's important. Okay. I would assume that if you want to have legislation, that you'd want to have a draft as soon as possible, so you can shop it around among the, you know, the constituency groups.
All right. Now, let's move to our cooperative action plans. I want to commend everybody for your hard work on this. The end products are here in front of you. What we want to spend the rest of our time today is working on these, and there's a lot of repetition, but that's probably a good thing, because some of the strategies that are suggested would have multiple impacts, and I think the legislature is going to like that if you have something that is going to address a number of problems. If you do it, that's a good thing. So what we need to do now is decide what stays and what goes, I guess, for lack of a better word, and probably some prioritization. I entertain, I guess, thoughts on how we should proceed at this point. Does anybody have any?
I don't have a thought about how to proceed, but I wanted to point out that there's some addendums to the three I submitted, because I didn't scroll down far enough.
Did everybody see those there?
So I'll get this, you know, into these final ones that Christy gave us, but I wanted to make sure they were here for this one.
Well, we can probably incorporate them when, because we're going to end up with a different product when we're done today. So, yeah, I think it's fine the way it is.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, I submitted mine when I don't see here. I submitted it on the due date to, I think, Leola, as you'd asked not to send anything to you directly, but I didn't send it on. Is mine? I wasn't sure if it was.
Because I thought we had them all.
Which one is yours? The provision of legal services. In a timely manner?
Yeah, I noticed that did not get
I have a copy. I brought
posted, but it was turned in, so I'm not sure what happened there.
So do we need to rent some copies?
Provision of appropriate legal services in a timely manner?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it didn't get posted with the others, but could you make a copy of this?
This is Lori Fellows. I don't see that the one I submitted was posted yesterday either.
Madam Chair?
Correct, I don't see that one either.
They all came, though, by email earlier. If they didn't come yesterday, I mean, doesn't everybody have all the... I have yours.
I have Lori's from that original email that you're talking about.
All right.
Printed
with this group, so I wanted to make sure they weren't missing.
And Lori's definitely including the correction. So,
okay. Because I think we're going to need a hard copy to...
I have Lori's hard copy with me. Right here.
So she's got Lori's hard copy.
So do I.
It wouldn't take any copy now.
Improved front end. The one we're talking about is improved front end dependency case management.
Right. I didn't print them out because I knew Christy was printing them out, so I didn't bring
separate copies.
So we'll make a copy of that.
Services make us some copies right now.
Great, thanks. Well, how many do we need? Folks seem to have brought everything.
The one from Lori Fellows.
Print it out.
There are two versions of it. The first, do you have one to copy?
This one I was just handed. Is this the one that we need?
It doesn't look right. And that's the reason she corrected hers. There were some things left off.
Okay.
And this is the corrected one.
Do you mind if I grab that?
Grab it.
And we'll make sure. Okay. I apologize for this. Do you guys want to stand at ease for a moment while I grab these, or do you want to continue?
We can continue because we can start with.
Yes. While you're able, go ahead and use it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's. Let's talk about how we should proceed at this point. We'll get all of these in front of us by goal. Sorry for the coughing. I've got terrible allergies. Any thoughts, Leola? Do you?
Reading all this stuff, you know, like you said a few minutes ago, there's some very clear the big picture issues are pretty clear, and there appears to be a lot of common attitudes about the issue of representation that cut all the way across. And because this is a legislative task force, the things that I would hope that maybe we could proceed to talk about stuff that is legislative in nature as the priority, because after all, if it's not for the legislature, we have time, or whoever would follow us would have time to figure out what to do about some of that other stuff.
So what we could do is we could start through each one of these and try to identify what would be specific to the legislature. Because we've got a lot of things that other people can do without any cost. But the purpose, as Judge Welch said, of this committee is to make recommendations to the legislature. So,
I also think that part of our task is to come back to the legislature and say which each of the stakeholders are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to be able to say, here's the barrier that we identified.
Here's what
here's what CASA is going to do. Here's what DHS is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are things that none of us can do unless there is a change in statute or additional funding.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that would come in the form of a bill that we would have to put together. But I think one of the things that we want to report back is, here was the problem, and here is what we're going to do.
Okay.
Each of the stakeholders.
All
right. And I'm not sure, you know, with some of the things that people said that they could do within the current law and within the current budget, how easy is it for you to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there may not be a barrier of funding or a barrier of a change in statute, but is there a barrier? Is there some barrier that would prevent you from doing that other than those two things? Because I think we should talk about that. What are those barriers to implementing the things that we're each suggesting we can do without additional funding or without changing the statute?
All right. We could start with that. Identifying within each one of these what we could start with what can be done within current law and budgetary restraints and identify the barriers that people have to doing those things so that we've got those memorialized. Does that sound like something that we should do first so that we're not recommending something that actually nobody can do because we don't have any staff or we don't have any time or whatever it is?
Because those may actually tie into the next step.
The next step, maybe they need to move. Well, and that, I guess that would be another concern, is everything that we put that we could do within current law and budgetary restraints in the right place? Can we really do it within the current law and budgetary restraints, or does it need to be moved to requiring additional funding?
And that was something that I think I commented to everybody when I sent out our draft strategies, that in looking at this specific goal area, yes, this is something that we could do. However, if we added all of these different 8 goal areas together, I would be challenged to think that we would be able to do everything that's listed for all of them within current budget. So,
For example, if you look at the very first one, the one that the juvenile dependency cases be prioritized and occurred in a timely manner, the one that I was the lead on, defense attorney strategies, advocate for appointment of counsel prior to shelter hearings, that if we, in some counties, that isn't, that's within the current budget because they're doing it. But in other counties, it would be an additional cost to somebody because they're not doing it now. And so I would assume that it would add an additional cost.
Would it add a cost if, in fact, you were appointing those attorneys anyway, just after the shelter hearing?
How are they? They're paid by the hour, aren't they?
Nope. No, they're paid by the appointment, and so...
I thought we've got some that are paid both ways.
There are jurisdictions where if we run out of our contract lawyers who are paid on a flat rate basis,
that's us.
Will be an hourly attorney appointed, but only about 2.5% of our entire statewide caseload, that's both criminal and juvenile, are handled by hourly attorneys. So it is more common in your area because it's rural.
Because we run out.
But on a statewide...
So it probably would not have a significant funding impact then.
Correct. Not for us. I think that what we hear is that it's typically that our lawyers are obligated to be in multiple places at multiple times, and so it could have an impact if we don't have the ability to adjust things on dockets so that lawyers aren't required to be multiple places at multiple times. There are jurisdictions where in order to resolve the issue, we just need to add lawyers so that people have availability to be there, assuming there isn't flexibility on what can happen within the docketing times for all the participants in the system.
And if we add another hearing and appearance at a flat rate, then they are getting paid even a little bit less for more work.
That is correct.
Although I think in the long run, that's less, so. Well, shall we, shall we just, shall we do that? Here we've got the... The other thing is, are there things in here that people identified that we maybe want, I guess, are there things that maybe we want to remove, or are there areas that we didn't get enough, or that kind of thing, too, we need to discuss, so...
So one of the things I realized when we started filling these out is that the second two strategies are related to changes in law.
Mm-hmm.
No new funds with new funds. There are other strategies where I could have recommended, well, I didn't need any change in law, I just need more money.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have that category.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that on the table. I sort of left the other two categories blank from DHS perspective because I don't really need a law change.
Just need
to
more.
Do some of those strategies.
Can I make a proposal?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we should start with the one that's provision of appropriate legal services in a timely manner and kind of just talk about each of those areas and walk through it, because as Judge Welch said, that was one of the areas across the board that there's been a lot of discussion on, and I think that impacts these other ones as well. So if we kind of start there and start walking through it, we can see
right.
how it goes and then figure out the rest.
Okay, this is the one that Joanne and Angela were the leads on, and
thank you.
As Leola said, it is involved in every single of the others. So I guess working on this one is probably where we should start. I agree, and they didn't have any. They had either stuff we could do with existing ones or things that could be done with additional funding. So
Madam Chair, I was thinking when I was looking at some of these strategies, I was trying to come up with things that I thought that we could do internally, or maybe to mm-hmm. work with DHS to do internally. And but then occasionally, you know, I had ideas about other people's mm-hmm. roles, but they may not agree with them. You know, and I noticed some other things too. Maybe like some people thought, well, if this group did this, this might help. Mm-hmm. So I don't know mm-hmm. if people have even seen these. I don't know if we want to have consensus on some things or
yes.
at least highlight.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Right. So I don't know if we want to do that, like take a court strategies and go through them and see if there's any questions or comments
mm-hmm.
and do it that way.
Okay. Well, let's just start with that, with court strategies. The my initial reaction to that is that I think, I don't know if we put it in ours, but the is those are kind of parts of going to the idea that the that there should be certification or standards or something that attorneys have to meet, and which would pick up those things. So there's probably a broader strategy that we could put there that would pick up those particular individual things. Any thoughts on that? Or
well, I mean, on that first strategy, to recommend that the attorney visit the child in the home, and if that is something that this group agrees on, is that something that we could ask be written into the contract, to their contract?
And it is. Lawyers are supposed to adhere to performance standards,
mm-hmm.
and those are part of the Oregon State Bar performance standards. So in an instance where a lawyer, in instances where lawyers are not visiting their child clients, typically a call is made to our office. I mean, and that's something that we would address. If a call isn't made and then we don't know, then we don't have the opportunity to address it. But
so I think what they're supposed to be doing it, the issue that I've had is making sure that they are. So you know, I've got some attorneys that are very clear to me, you know, I went to the home, this is what I saw, and others that I know have never been there. So as a court, you know, a simple way is just simply it all reviews and everything, ask the attorney, have you visited the child in the home?
A lot of times we get that I've sent somebody to visit and it's not
right.
the same, and
mm-hmm.
so do the performance standards require the person or somebody from their office to go?
There are times when people will send someone from their office. It is preferred to have the lawyer go.
Mm-hmm.
But I should also comment that I think that some attorneys, at least
when I was representing children, employed a strategy of alternating visits between home and school
mm-hmm.
so that the child always had a safe place to disclose.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, sometimes it's appropriate to make sure that you also meet with a child in an environment outside of the home. And so we don't want to get too probably prescriptive about what it looks like, but ideally the attorney should be having visits with the client. I mean, that is the way you form an attorney-client relationship. So,
and from a legal perspective, too, that sometimes, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Nancy, but sometimes I think the attorney parent or the child's attorney, if they see something, they become then a potential witness. If they send an investigator, then they can have someone to testify. So maybe not for just a quick visit, but if I've heard that from children's attorneys that they prefer to send an investigator from their office or an assistant from their office to have a contact in the home and to observe in the home, and then they prefer to meet with their client elsewhere at school or at other places. And I know it's probably not consistent.
I was going to say, I think there are a variety of approaches,
right.
But there's no doubt that lawyers need to be meeting with their clients.
And then that's sort of where I'm concerned about a little crossover. I mean, I think it's easy for the court to have that inquiry and do that discussion, but I see the same lawyers all the time in court with me. And
right.
So then I'm also, then that kind of overflows into, when are they actually doing their meetings with
mm-hmm.
children, parents, you know, whoever they're representing, we see a lot of each other, and so I don't know what free time
right.
they actually have.
Right.
So then that becomes a resource issue.
That is. That's a caseload issue where
okay.
if all of your time is court time, you don't have the opportunity. And that actually is a reason often that a lawyer will send
mm-hmm.
A representative from their office, because if you're stuck in trial for a week and a child needs a visit that week, you need to get someone out there, even if it's not you.
The biggest thing that made a difference for me and the attorneys actually meeting with their kids is when I started requiring the kids to appear at reviews and permanency hearings. And then they had to meet with them to get ready for the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise they weren't. I'd get in there and it had been months and months and months since they'd had any contact with the kid.
And the juvenile court representation standards for parents and kids' attorneys are being rewritten right now. In fact, I'm missing that meeting to be
mm-hmm.
here. So they're very close to finalizing. So kind of a strategy that I had thrown out there was that, and I think Nancy had it too, was that maybe adoption of, because that's going to be done very shortly, and education around the representation standards. I know
mm-hmm.
maybe a lot of judges aren't aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some changes that were made could be highlighted in a bullet point form and given out to all the judges
mm-hmm.
with some education around the requirements and then the inquiries to potentially make if they want to.
So I will tell you what I did on those when they first came out is I had a mandatory, we had a training that Judge Pratt was the presiding then, and he required that anybody to get an appointment, they had to show up. And we covered a whole bunch of things, but one of the things we did is we trained on the standards right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that anybody's actually done that in court with their attorneys other than me.
So I noticed that in the goal area of an adequate supply of quality representation for all parties, one of the court strategies there is to get training on and expect compliance with the standards and expectations for defense and agency attorneys. So is this whole issue more an issue of the adequate supply of quality representation or appropriate legal services? And this is where kind of things were crossing over and combining. And
this is so non-controversial in terms of
yeah.
this body.
Mm-hmm.
Can't we
just
simply say that there should be up-to-date performance standards and supportive education for all attorneys involved in the representation of the parties to this, and then gather the items which are sprinkled around that principle. It's not something that I think there's any difference of opinion about.
I agree.
Right. I noted it's all, it, of course, it's also in the training for all participants.
Yeah,
it is. It's,
yeah, that's over here on the second page. That was me. Right now, there isn't a requirement that they be certified or anything like that, is there?
No, and there are states that actually have a they offer a certification. It has been, my understanding is, a fairly expensive proposition, but I could find out more information about how other states approach certification.
Expensive proposition to the attorneys?
Well, the way I did it, by requiring them to show up at the one I did and handing it to them and having somebody talk to them about it, at least I knew that they were aware of it. And I don't think that was the case prior to doing that. Of course, that was when the standard just came out. That was a number of years ago. But
so can we, it sounds like you said that they're maybe already doing this. Say what we want to require the trainings to be as and include that in their contract that says, I did these trainings, but we've said we need to make sure that we think these are important trainings that they've had. We need to make sure not only are those stated, but they're done and they're listed in their contract that say, yes, I've done those. So that would take care of like the training piece of it, and maybe some of the accountability piece in terms of yes, I know the information. I'm telling you, I know the information. But then we still have the accountability piece. You may know it, but then you may not still be doing it.
Right.
Which is what some of us can point to and see. Sometimes we see this.
Right. And our contracts currently do require that juvenile practitioners they actually have to certify that they are meeting our training requirements in juvenile cases. The difficulty for us is the accountability piece. There are well over, I believe over 400 attorneys practicing in the juvenile arena. It might be over 350, but it's in that range. And so actually individually monitoring all of those is an administrative strain on our organization. We don't have anyone in a position to be doing that level of monitoring. People are certifying that they're doing it, and if we get someone approaches us with a concern, we can then go do the deeper look, but it would be difficult to do that on all attorneys within existing resources.
Well, the other issue is the court's responsibility to hold lawyers to standards. You know, OPDS doesn't have to be the only place where the word comes from, so I would think that would be an element as well that judges should, if they learn that this is that these any of these rules are not being followed or any of these standards are not being met, that they talk to the lawyer about it rather than sending them all to PBS.
Right, and that question came up last year at the Juvenile Court Improvement Program conference. I talked about the emerging performance standards, what we were going to be expecting in the future, and that question came up from a judge, and I'm not remembering who it was at the moment, but his question was, I understand OPDS can be a resource for investigating complaints, but aren't I the first layer of accountability? And so it is something where everyone engaging in the process is going to yield a better outcome.
But we can say we all agree that the model rules are, what are we calling them?
Performance standards
as revised are should be trained on and certify they're actually performing under those standards.
Which is the way it's on the adequate supply for all parties. That's the first one.
Yeah.
So we can move that over here and take off these first two, probably.
Right. And I feel like I should follow up because the Board of Governors is actually looking at the proposed performance standards, and I know they have a concern that if they adopt the performance standards, which are arguably more detailed and more onerous than the previous standards, that it could be setting lawyers up for malpractice claim type of claims. And so we're being very clear with them. These standards have always been adopted as aspirational standards. Mm-hmm. And so what I want to be clear about is that I believe that is the bar's expectation this time, again, is that that these will be adopted as aspirational standards. Mm-hmm. So they set out what the performance is, but bar discipline will not follow mm-hmm. as a result of not meeting the standards to the letter. And so I mention that only because it is important to put the performance standards in context. And as I said, they'll be meeting on the 25th and having this conversation in more detail. But I know that the BOG, at least, is very concerned that it be clear that these standards are not standards that would trigger discipline.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Right.
But it also...
They're signing a contract, which you're paying them for, so while they may not be legally, you know, the bar may not do anything, the person that's paying them the money can,
yep.
right? Because you can hold them accountable to their contract. And then maybe we suggest that the judges... I don't know how you do this with judges, but if you suggest with the judges that at a hearing they point blank ask the attorneys, when is the last time that you saw your client?
Mm-hmm.
Just ask the question.
I think we've also just talked about the bar, monitoring the bar, and I'm wondering where, if you all see a role for DHS understanding these standards and being a part of that as well, because I don't know where we'd get that training.
Well, I think that's the multidisciplinary training
mm-hmm.
piece that we all need to be in the room as we're talking about what the roles and responsibilities are of each person in that courtroom.
What I really like is I like bench cards, and we had one for a long time for review hearings, and that Judge Pratt and I used that just had a list of things that we should be sure to hit on, and I think that's really helpful for judges because you're doing a whole bunch of these and there's a lot going on, and if you have some key things, and one of them is, you know, on the model order there's a thing as that the court heard from the child in an appropriate manner and everything, and they always mark that, and I'll say, well, wait a minute, the kid isn't here, you know, how did I hear from the child here, you know. And so, you know, having something that says you're going, you know, to the attorney, did you visit him in the home, you know, like what's going on at school, you know, all those kind of things, so you just remember to hit those points and get it from somebody if the child isn't there. And I still don't think that's the usual practice throughout the state to have the kids there.
And I would comment to the multidisciplinary, you know, going over roles and responsibilities. I hear a lot about DHS's responsibility, but I do not hear regularly, nor are attorneys regularly receptive from DHS telling them what their responsibility is or understanding their responsibility. And so that's why I say, where would I get that training for my workers mm-hmm. on what those standards were, what they are, and then what is the, I mean, I'm a member of the bar. I understand that culture,
mm-hmm.
and it's not received well
mm-hmm.
when a layperson involved in this process raises issues of attorney performance.
When we did the training on it, we did, you know, it was funny, you probably heard about it, because we organized this multidisciplinary training in the courtroom, and I get in there and all the caseworkers and the social service people are sitting on one side and the
yeah.
lawyers are over here, you know. And that was when I was mad at them because I had gone to what was the one before the current one, the trainings that you did all over the state about 3-4 years ago on the anyway,
before differential response.
The differential response, and none of the attorneys had come. So they had to sit through that, and then the caseworker sat through the training on the defense standards, and it was very interesting because they started to have some dialogue back and forth.
Good.
And so I think that if you train multidisciplinary and people start to see what other people's responsibilities are, that can really break that barrier down to in a different way, and they can see where there's overlap and where there's other things, because I don't think any of the caseworkers had any idea there were any standards that the attorneys had to meet until they heard that. And the lawyers clearly didn't know about differential response because they hadn't shown up to any of the trainings, so we made them sit through it. And I think that's the way you got to do it. It's what worked for us, is to get everybody in the room and do it multidisciplinary so they understand everybody else's roles.
How many jurisdictions do you believe has have done that?
I don't know if anybody's done that.
I know that Judge Henry had she just did a brown bag. Mm-hmm. Everybody come in the courtroom and she's going to cover mm-hmm. X topic. She didn't think anybody was going to show up, and it was packed.
Yeah.
So not a big formal to-do, but it was at least getting everybody at the table. So mm-hmm.
What the court had to do is we had to clear the docket so that nobody had any excuses for not coming. There was no court that day, and we did it in the courtroom, and so nobody could say they couldn't show up, and the judges were going to be there. And
so perhaps with Jason, because we do regional and county level multidisciplinary trainings all the time, we can look at working with PDSC and anybody else about kind of collaborating and what that would look like and develop it and kind of do it as a roadshow next year. So my question that goes along with that, Lois, is are there standards specifically for agency attorneys if we're going to be looking at trying to increase representation? And
yeah, I've never been trained on any standards for agency attorneys, but I bet Joanne has.
Yeah, there are ABA standards for attorneys that represent social or child welfare agencies.
Okay.
And that's what's passed around at DOJ and trained to.
And
there was some discussion when we were, I was brought in late to the Juvenile Court Representation Standards group that's been meeting for quite a long time now, because it's slow going through all of these things, and everyone has, of course, things to say and add. And so there was some discussion about whether to have a state's attorney version that was different than the ABA standards.
I don't want them coming to my home.
Yeah, exactly. We'll come to Lois's home, I'm afraid we can. And then it's hard because the state's attorneys, the DDAs, don't represent DHS, so they don't represent an agency, and they would have different standards, and they are each their own individual office, and they, you know, they would have to determine whether or not each individual county would be willing to do that, or through an ODAA representative, perhaps. But that was separate and apart from kind of...
Actually, I think that's where there's the biggest training.
Yeah,
is for DDAs. They assign the, you know... I just went through that a couple weeks ago where, you know, this guy's been working in the DA's office for 2 months and they send him in to do this stuff, and, you know, and then you end up with this weird hearing where the judge is acting as the DA in a lot of ways because they don't know, have any idea what's going on. And I think that's been a bigger problem than anything else.
And Madam Chairman, you know, I'm sitting on this from the ODAA, and I think that it is difficult with so many different district attorney's offices, and I think the level of commitment to juvenile practice varies greatly amongst offices.
Yeah.
And then the ABA standards have a minimum caseload, which, you know, it's the same kind of, which we don't adhere to at all. We have, you know, significantly more than that. And so I think if you start opening that kind of worms, it could potentially tie in nicely to something like this, but at the time it wasn't determined to be part of the OSB standards because it was really focused on parents' attorneys and children's attorneys at that time. So we're more than happy to participate in recrafting something, or perhaps with this committee's engagement, having a different approach to crafting something with tying in reduced caseloads, or tying in, you know, with the pilot, perhaps tying in a new kind of standards for agency attorneys if they were representing the agency from start to finish. I think it's hard when we're brought in and out.
a weird barrier that I had when I did the training myself was getting the CLE credits, because the bar charges you to do that, and I had no money to pay, you know, to do that. So I they let me kind of backdoor it in, which I don't need to go into detail how we did it to get CLE credits, but the bar could help on something like that, on these kind of trainings, so that we can be sure that people get CLE credits for them, because that's a key to getting the lawyers to show up at all, is if they're going to get the credits.
I want to be a voice of encouragement for mm-hmm. standards for state's lawyers, because I do think it helps to have that clarity. And I know that when we organized the 2012 Juvenile Law Training Academy, we had an entire panel discussion on the emerging standards, and there was a state's representative discussing the potential, and it was there was a recognized division between district attorney role and DOJ role. And while I appreciate the fact that there are 36 different counties, and coming to consensus about what standards ought to be is difficult, if we have over 300 providers across the state on the defense side and we can come to some consensus about standards, it seems like a doable task. And we have the ABA standards to look toward. And I think that when you talk about multidisciplinary trainings, it's very helpful to have something documented, so you know what your what is your goal, what are the expectations. And without it, I think it becomes very difficult to achieve the objectives we want. And I will follow that up to say that in conversations I have, I think one of the biggest struggles is that there isn't consistency in the way that the state prosecutes an initial petition, and there isn't consistency even once jurisdiction is established necessarily in how a case is proceeded upon. And when there are newer district attorneys, just like when there are newer defense attorneys, when there's someone prosecuting that petition who doesn't have the depth of knowledge and the training, it really can send a case very far sideways. And so I just want to voice my strong support for a continued discussion about standards for all parties.
And also a coordination in the office with companion criminal charges. That can really astonishes me in an office with four attorneys how sometimes that communication isn't there, and you get something going on in the criminal case that really impacts the juvenile case that nobody knows about, or vice versa.
I think too, if at least there can be an information exchange between all the parties about what the standards are and what the expectations are for each of, because somebody said, what are the expectations for each person in that courtroom? If those standards are at least exchanged and they're aspirational, then I think the court can take a role in kind of making sure we're all trying to aspire to those standards by focusing on what the right inquiries are. And then there's that accountability piece. But then we could just try to encourage the courts to do that in a consistent way.
So our strategy that we have listed on the quality representation is standards for defense and agency attorneys. There aren't any for the agency attorneys. So do we want to recommend that there be standards for those folks?
You know, I think we train to the ABA standards, mm-hmm. but that you're right, there's no official Oregon State Bar standards. And I think it's tricky because the ABA standards talk, you know, we're not consistent, we don't represent the agency from day one to the end. And so we're brought in and out of cases, and the role is different depending on how involved we are in the case. So it just, depending on what happens with future legislation around representation of the agency, I mean, that to spend a lot of time to craft something.
Well, I love the way it's worded here on the, if you look under DOJ, DA, attorney standards, adoption and education regarding OSB representation for juvenile court practitioners. Juvenile court practitioners would be everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems to me that that should be the aspiration.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, I think it's...
And that includes judges, for that matter.
To have everybody know the standard. Because I do think a lot of it may be, you know, it's learned early on and forgotten, not put into practice for lots of people. And And then I think it's hard, too, with attorneys in a small consortium that work together on a daily basis to point out something somebody's doing wrong. So it's nice that if there is that kind of exchange where everyone's aware of it, when it's brought up later, it's not an attack on an individual. It's more of like...
See, and I think the judges have been way ahead on this because of the Juvenile Court Improvement Project. We've been training, and really trying to get the expertise with juvenile court judges and family court judges, and it works. You don't just have people do it that don't know what's going on. So, well, that there again, there doesn't seem to be any disagreement on this. It's just where we want to put it and how we want to word it. So,
it doesn't have to continue. Do we have to continue to follow this grid, or was this just a way to start the process? I'm not sure.
It's a way of looking at, you know, we're going to have to write a report at some point, and so it's a way of keeping it kind of organized for what the goals are. But, you know, as we've said, there's an awful lot of overlap.
And the way the grid is used at the local level is that people are making commitments to do something to move something forward.
Mm-hmm.
So it clearly shows what CASAs are going to do or what DHS is going to commit to doing. So it's what the local people feel that their piece of the process, what their commitments can be.
Mm-hmm. But it's clear that some global things are emerging
from cross over everyone. So it sounds to me that get training on and expect compliance with the performance standards and expectations for juvenile court practitioners is something that would run across everything here.
Run across everything. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we pulled that out. All right.
So do we want to make it broader than that and say for all participants in the juvenile court process versus just juvenile court practitioners?
Well, that would be the clients and things, too, so we need a different...
Professional participants.
Yeah.
Is DHS, is this really a caseworker discussion? I don't think it is. Isn't it more legal...
Unless what we're targeting is the idea of multidisciplinary trainings, or social workers are becoming more aware of what the expectations are for the lawyers, too, in which case professional participants or something along that line would maybe more broadly define the category without roping in clients.
And CASAs and everybody else. I think it's just really important to get everybody there at the table. You know?
So, I mean, I would advocate for expanding it to include DHS and CASAs, because I think it would be good for caseworkers to know what the expectations are of the legal representatives in the court.
Mm-hmm. That's the training part, but the standard setting part.
Is
for lawyers.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
But the training should be, well, we've got it over here, cross training. In the CASA strategies, it's more, I think everybody's saying that everybody needs to know what everybody else does, and they need to know each other.
So it's really setting standards, cross-training everybody, and then there's this piece of accountability, which is, and I think that's the harder piece, is coming up, like, you know, Lois mentioned. So what if you are a caseworker and you're working with an attorney that isn't meeting the standards? But do we want all the caseworkers calling Nancy? I mean, maybe there needs to be to be like an agreement between the stakeholders about how that process is handled. Like, because otherwise you know the information and you feel frustrated and helpless. Mm-hmm. Because there's nowhere to go
And that was one of my recommendations too, I think, was to not have, I mean, I think the thought is to rise to the level to call Nancy or to register a complaint is a pretty high bar, and not many people want to do that because they work with these people and like these people, and you don't want to call out somebody or you represent a child on one case, but you're going to be a parent attorney on the next case. And but I can't remember which group I put it under now, but my thought was maybe a kind of sounding board to kind of like, you know, you call the bar if you have an ethics concern and it's kind of anonymous and is this an issue or not. And if there was, I think it's under required funding, but if there was some group tied into Nancy's area that people could call if they had a question about, so I have a case where this is happening, is that a concern or not a concern?
Right.
But something like that, perhaps. So it would be a way to address without rising to the level of registering a formal complaint.
I did a training with CASAS, and I had to really work with them because they were very reluctant to tell me in their reports what was going on with the attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them that I really, you know, if you're getting an attorney that never returns your calls, that when you see the kid has no idea who this person is because they've never met him, I'm relying on you to tell me that. And I think that there's a lot of, with CASAS and caseworkers too, they're really struggling with how much they should to tell about that. Because if they put it in the report, for example, if you put it in the court report for the review hearing for all to see, the attorney's likely to go, you know, ballistic on you.
Yeah, it significantly impairs the relationship
if you do that
for caseworkers to call attorneys on the standards.
On the carpet on that.
But the attorneys flip. I mean, attorneys that are upset with a caseworker will call the caseworker supervisor or upset with the CASA, we say,
well, that,
call us, tell us if you're having a problem with the CASA.
And they're not reluctant at all to complain about the caseworker in open court, but it doesn't go back the other way. And so it's real frustrating for the court to find out that, you know, this has gone on for months and you never knew it.
So, you know, I think the courts are the great equalizers, mm-hmm. frankly, of the relationships. And mm-hmm. so if there was something on a bench card mm-hmm. that just asked, how many times have you seen your client and where, or whatever the you know, the inquiry would be, it removes the burden from mm-hmm. the you know, the worker or the cost or whatever.
I don't think judges will do that.
Well,
not in open court. I mean, I wouldn't do it in open court if somebody called to my attention that there was a problem and that happened over the years. I would talk to the. It was a lawyer. I would talk to the lawyer privately, not in front of the clients, not in front of.
It's interesting because caseworkers have to actually put in the court report how many times they see the parents and the children and where.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more issues than just seeing the client. I mean,
sure.
In terms of whether
and there's a difference with
job.
The parents too, because the parents will tell you, they'll come in and they'll say, I couldn't get a hold of him, he didn't call me, you know, they'll complain away, but a kid isn't going to.
So approximately 7 to 10 years ago when I was working in Jackson County, the juvenile judges then, which at the time there were three, were highly concerned about the lack of the attorney's visits mm-hmm. with the child. In fact, there were times when the attorney had never met the child.
Right.
And they took it upon themselves to ask from the bench, when was the last time you saw your client? Yeah. At every hearing. And it was a very short period of time before CASAS were getting calls from attorneys saying, where does the kid live?
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely affected that that county at the time. I don't know how that they're operating now. I've been in Linn County for a long time. But my other thought was around accountability. I think if there's some cross-training that's done and there's better and greater understanding by each of the participants in the juvenile process of what the standards are for the others, that does bring into, it raises an opportunity for better accountability. I think that always raises it. It would be nice if there was also an understood mechanism of when there is a concern, where do you go? So I think that's an opportunity in that cross-training process.
I think if you can get the players in the room at the same time mm-hmm. to cross train so that everybody knows,
right?
Here's where we're at, because it is DHS caseworkers get called out all the time by whoever, attorneys, parents, and I think if it's not just isolated or you're training by discipline, I think you can have a better chance of having the group hold one another accountable without actually having to go to report anyone in particular. And we had a similar situation in Lane County where it wasn't the visits between the attorneys and the children, but just some general things we weren't getting in court reports from caseworkers. And so we started having them fill out forms, and all of a sudden everybody's good. That, you know, those pieces of information that weren't coming, the culture's changed now. That's always there. So I think it's just figuring out what we all kind of globally expect from one another and an easy way to implement expectations, even if we don't have the formal standards all put together. So.
Is it really off? I mean, I'm not an attorney, but would it be really off base to ask the attorney to, you know, DHS submits a court report, CASA submits a court report, CRB's has a written recommendations that come to the court. Would it be totally out of the question to ask the attorney to submit, that maybe we just create a form and it's just a checkoff form that says, I saw the child, you know, whatever it is, just, you know, maybe bringing the information that the attorney has also in writing to the court. And it, maybe not a big old lengthy court report, but maybe just a checkoff form or something.
Right. And I think that the lawyer's professional responsibility is to advocate for their client. And so that advocacy can take many forms. They have an obligation to meet with their client. They have an obligation to file motions when it's appropriate. And they have an obligation to keep information confidential when that's part of what the relationship is with the client. And so I don't think there is a way to have a general form that requires the lawyer to report any kind of uniform information to the court. I don't think that runs against the court making an inquiry about
right.
having seen the client. Though there are times when even that could run afoul of a lawyer's confidentiality agreement with the client. So I think there is a training issue, and I think that what you will see is that lawyers who are consistently meeting with their clients, that it becomes obvious that they are advocating in ways that demonstrate a knowledge of who their client is and what their client needs and wants.
I mean, it's a complicated area, because where the attorneys get into problems is, you know, if the judge is yelling at them that they haven't met with their client, and it's a parent, and the parent canceled 5 different appointments, and they know that that's going to be used against them because that shows that they're not doing stuff, that puts the attorney in a real bad spot. If the attorney, if the foster parent, it doesn't want a parade of people in the home, and I've had this happen where, and again, if I don't know about it, I can't do anything about it, and neither can the agency, but the foster parent needs to understand that they're going to have to facilitate meetings with the attorney, they're going to have to facilitate meetings with the CASA, and part of being a foster parent in this day and age is that you're going to have to accommodate those things. And if you can't handle that, if you don't want people coming over to your house and checking you out, then you shouldn't be a foster parent. And I think those things have been hard for people to deal with, some of those issues, because they don't want to get a foster parent in trouble, or they don't want to get their client in trouble by explaining that the reason they didn't meet with them was because of that, or, you know, whatever. So it can be kind of touchy. I think you can tell with the regular attorneys who's doing it and who isn't doing it. But I don't practice in an area where there's lots of attorneys and lots of people, and, you know, and I'm surprised sometimes how much it slides by me, but I think in a bigger county it would be more of a problem, because
some lawyers are very good actors.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
If I may add, at least in Multnomah County, the expectation is children's attorneys usually start their presentation by announcing to the group when the last time they had contact, and whether it was their contact or their legal assistant's contact. So maybe that's just the way the judges have trained the bar here, but we are routinely getting that information during hearings from the practitioners.
I still think, I come down that I think that's the best way to do it, is just have the judge have, you know, it doesn't have to be a big grilling, you know, how many times and how many minutes or anything else, but, you know, are you reporting to me the information from a direct contact, or are you just telling me what the caseworker told you?
Well, does that apply to parents' representation, too, though?
It can sometimes, especially if the parents are complaining about them.
But it's awkward.
It's awkward,
yeah.
It can be very...
Yeah, and I see it... I see the representation of children in the juvenile court system and parents differently. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a different relationship. The nature of the client is so different that I can... How often they see the parents, like you say, you don't want an attorney to say, well, I tried, Your Honor, five times, and my client sitting here with me now stood me up.
Yeah.
But I get that there's an ethical issue there. And I don't really think attorneys need to be seeing infants, the same schedule they might need to see a kid who's 10
yeah.
or 15. You don't see a difference?
Well,
I think
for the safety of the child, you're one of the gatekeepers, and no matter the age, if you're not in that home with some regularity, or meeting with your client, if it's an older client who can meet in a different location, you just run the risk of having something bad happen to your client. So, you know.
Well, I think there really is a difference in representing a child from anything else that you do as an attorney. And maybe that's part of the issue, because I know when we first started appointing attorneys for children, the attorneys were just, dumbfounded as to how to even handle this as a client. How do I represent a two-month-old? You know, what does that mean as an attorney? Because that goes against everything that you think of as how you have representation and relationships with clients. And I think how that's developed in the last 30 years has been very, very interesting. One of the things I like about the standards that you have now is that it makes a distinction about the special rules with children, and I think that that's really important for people to understand that are outside the system too. It's different when you're representing a child. And a lot of places don't do it that way. In Idaho, I think they appoint a guardian ad litem for all of them.
In Washington as well.
Yep. Yeah. And then the attorneys then are working with the guardian ad litem who's supposed to be, and then the guardian ad litem is supposed to be having a relationship with the child. We don't do that. We expect the attorney to have a direct relationship. So,
can it be the assignment of some work group to pull all of this, all of the things that are in all these materials that are relevant to this conversation together in some kind of organized fashion, and so that then it can be sort of a package?
A training, standards and training recommendation package.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems like a logical way to go rather than continuing to sort of parse through here.
Yeah.
Specifics.
Okay, that's a really good idea, and that might be what we could... Why don't we do that? Why don't we identify, so we use our time well, we've identified standards and trainings. Are there some other overriding themes that people have found when they look through all of these? Because I think there are. So
Representation. Period, yeah.
Yeah. Caseloads and representation and... the first one that comes to mind is that representation should start at the shelter care hearing, and that ran through a whole bunch of these, and I think there's no disagreement with anybody on that should be the practice.
And I think adjacent to that is the need for discovery in advance.
Yeah.
And we have very few jurisdictions where lawyers are actually getting the discovery
mm-hmm.
and soon enough before, with enough time between that and the preliminary hearing, the shelter hearing, that they have time to thoroughly review it, talk with their client, and come up with a proposed plan that would allow the family to stay together, any kind of safety plan. I mean, that's what lawyers should be doing before they get to that first shelter hearing.
How much time is that, do you think?
Oregon has the shortest, it's my understanding that Oregon has the shortest time period from removal to shelter care hearing in the United States. That the
That's why I'm asking, how much time would the attorney need to do that? Because it's 24 hours or less,
yeah.
And frequently it's the or less.
It is not possible.
Right, so it's not impossible. I mean, it's not ideal, and I think that Multnomah County was ahead of its time, and I haven't practiced there since 2006, mm-hmm. and I think they've made improvements since when I was there, but certainly my understanding of the current status is that I think that parents are getting there at about 11:30 in the morning, and discovery is available.
Ask Lori.
Lori, yes, tell us.
Well, they're asking parents, our shelter hearings start at 2:30 in the afternoon, and I believe parents are instructed to appear by, it's either 12:30 or 1. When they come in, they get an orientation, they fill out paperwork for court-appointed attorney, and then they have an opportunity to meet, although sometimes briefly, with the counsel that's going to be appointed for them before we actually walk into the shelter hearing at 2:30.
So it's not a lot of time, but it's at least enough time to get to review the information with your client, get some information about family and potential placements and potential safety plans, and as much as that can be moved forward in the day, you know, you build in some extra time for that kind of communication.
Yeah, you know, it used to be that the lawyers would walk in the room and we'd hand them the documentation as they sat down at counsel table, and that's just not productive for anybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everybody's really struggling with this. One solution would be to allow more time, but that means that kids stay in care longer before you have the initial judicial determination, and a lot of them... the result of the hearing is that something gets worked out where the kids don't stay in stranger foster care, or they move to a relative. So there's a lot of advantages to moving swiftly in terms of doing.
Well, and the other thing is, I don't know how many jurisdictions have second shelter hearings. We have the ability in Multnomah County to have a second shelter hearing within a few days or a week if we're in a posture where we can't quite get the relative or the safety service plan arranged at the first shelter hearing, but want to come back to court in a very quick turnaround to see if we can get those kids home.
And I think legally, I've taken the position that anybody can do that because you can continue the shelter care. And I do it all the time, and that we never have to have the second hearing because it gets worked out. But I do that all the time, especially when I've got parents that want to fight, but the attorney knows there's no fighting to be done. They're better to spend the time and energy working on something else.
The problem with that, Judge Sullivan, mm-hmm. is that there aren't enough juvenile court judges who are thinking about all those things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would hope somewhere in all this, although it doesn't really fit into the appointment of attorney discussion, the issue of what should happen in those first couple of weeks of a case would be nice to identify.
Well, that's our Leola and I's, use the bench card. Which I know they do in Multnomah County with great success. If you use the bench card, things will happen differently. So what we want with the shelter care thing is we want representation at shelter care with timely discovery as much as possible. So we're in.
Yeah, advanced.
Okay.
So are we keeping that on the provision, on this one that we identified as the standards and training recommendation package, or are we putting that on the improved front end?
I think that's an improved front end
case. Yeah. Okay.
So many courts that I'm aware of have shelter hearings first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so this becomes difficult, this kind of arrangement, when you're placing a child at 5 p.m.
Yeah.
And you have to be in court at 8:30 the next morning.
I don't think that's possible. I just wonder how you can even do that. Well, and the problem from a court's point of view, especially court administration, is that shelter care hearings are never scheduled. And so basically, in a jurisdiction like mine, we're always just fitting them in. And that means that we often, we have a terrible time. We'll have to call, say both
2 weeks ago, the other judge was out. I was the only one there. I'm in trial. We get a shelter care. We had to have a judge do it over the video from Umatilla County. You know, and that's what we're having to do. And it's hard to do a shelter care over the video, but we do them over the video all the time. And I do them for other counties that way because there's no schedule for it. It isn't like we can, Multnomah County, where they can set a time where they're going to be doing them every day. And we can go 2-3 weeks and not have one, and then we can have 3 in 1 week, which it seems like they kind of go that way. And so scheduling shelter care hearings at all with court time is a real problem. And I don't know how you do them at first thing in the morning, because we always have everything. We're scheduled harder first thing in the morning, and we're usually doing them at the very end of the day because we're just putting them on the end whenever we can do
them. Just love, how do y'all do it in Lane?
We do it at 8:30. It never starts at 8:30.
Yeah, because they're never ready.
And there's a lot of talk, but we have just had talks. I'm trying to get the attorneys ready for trying to move them to later in the day, probably 11. Mm-hmm. Leila was just suggesting a different time. We have dockets at 1:30, and so it's just all that juggling, and then we can have two judges out at juvenile court sometimes available, but because of attorney conflicts, you can't run two court yet, so then there's that overlap. But we, I haven't gotten any objection from DOJ or DHS or PDS to move it to.
And it's a problem for the attorneys, like, too, because what we'll do is we'll say, we took these kids, we'll get the report, we took these kids into care, there's two dads and a mom, and here's who they are, and so we have the choice of either waiting to see if two dads and a mom show up and then get them attorneys, or getting three attorneys over there to meet two dads and a mom and having only the mom show up and no dads, and wasted the attorney's time when you know, or they'll say dad's in prison, and so we don't have the attorney come, and there he is on the phone, you know. So it's a real problem figuring out how you arrange for representation, and we struggle with it every single time about whether we should have the, you know, have the attorney come over, and then somebody doesn't show up or what.
And I think the way it works with the consortium is there's a certain number of attorneys that are on call that morning. Yeah. Well, I'm waiting for differential response to kick in because we've been really busy with petitions. So, you know, on a morning, an attorney may be meeting 4 new clients.
Right,
that's
right.
Been pretty common to be that busy in the morning. And so they're trying to juggle getting to know each situation. And it's, so I don't get upset when we start late, but they're trying to get work done. It's not very much time for them.
So there's a piece of this, I think, around court docketing.
Yeah.
And what support do juvenile court judges actually have in terms of how they set the docket that can best get people educated and knowledgeable about what's going on in that place, in that time? And I know when I was in a branch, I was constantly, I wouldn't call them arguments, but I would constantly raise to our juvenile court judge how much time caseworkers spend sitting outside in the courtroom and not being able to go in and do their, you know, face-to-face visits. We'd love to go see the kids, but we're sitting in the court waiting for a hearing. And the docketing was always, you know, the judge has to set the docket so that the court's work can get done, but there's an impact on all the participants in the court's work based on how the docket is set up. So I think it's great if you move shelter hearings away from 8:30 in the morning, because that is, has never really served folks very well.
The other thing is, to me, a successful shelter care hearing is where the grandparents and the lady from the church and the sister-in-law and everybody are all there. So, and you can't do that at 8:30 in the morning either, usually very well.
Well, and I think we find that, I mean, if you're going to have a petition filed, the parents are struggling. And so 8:30 is not an easy time, you know, and
and a lot of them, the first thing, you know, if you took the kids, say, at 8 o'clock that night before, their first reaction was to use right after everybody left. And so they'll, getting people sober and coherent at 8:30 in the morning is
not the best hour for that.
What this is, to the extent that there is a solution for this stuff in the broader, is
there need to be more judges doing the work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that's something, that's another main topic here, and that is how many, how do you figure out how many juvenile court judges are needed in a particular court and getting money to have more judges? Because mm-hmm. we need more judges. Maybe not in Portland, but.
Right. And I think along with that, I wonder if there is a need for, and I don't want to step over a line I shouldn't, mm-hmm. but it seems like recommended court docketing strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that would, if there were clear expectations, that would help me too, because when I go out to jurisdictions and talk to providers, you know, people get set in their ways, mm-hmm. and it's hard for people to envision something different. If there are recommended strategies, for particularly for different court sizes, that then I can talk with my providers about, that's helpful because it helps bring them around to change too. I mean, it sounds like you're not getting any pushback from lawyers and Lane, mm-hmm. which is great, but to the extent that that becomes a sticking point, it's nice to have something to point to say, well, this is a recommended strategy.
But you have to have people.
Yes.
You have to have enough dockets and enough bodies.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You can't. The TCAs can't make it go away yeah. without that.
Well, and I think the expectations on the court for every hearing have just, you know, every year they just expand what the judges have to manage in each individual type of hearing. And so, to me, it makes sense that you'd have additional judicial resources committed to it. But I guess my question is, isn't that decided on a local level?
No.
Mm-hmm. How many judges you have but what they do? So, in Lane, Judge Love is the juvenile court judge, and there's access to another one when needed, but it's not like there's two assigned to juvenile court.
Not for dependency.
Yeah.
And then Washington County has two assigned full-time.
But that would be made. That yeah. decision would be made locally, right? So maybe there's standards we could.
That decision is made locally.
That's what I'm saying, is that we could allocate more judges, and they could end up doing misdemeanors or something.
Arraignments,
docket call or whatever.
What might be interesting is what they did with post-conviction relief, which is very interesting because they didn't have enough judges for that, and. They use Plan B for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And that's provided a pool of available judges to take this particular area and be able to keep it going, and it's been very innovative, and this might cry out for something similarly innovative because that procedure is totally unique to itself and has been a very successful response to just simply not having enough judges and enough time.
But again, I think, and I'm repeating myself, but we sometimes have two judges sitting out there. If I have a conflict and want somebody to come out, you know, have somebody come out to hear the Smith's case or whatever, I can't start any of my eight other hearings that are scheduled because because everybody's, we've got a limited number of attorneys, and there's so many people at the table for each hearing. So I think I have a better argument to make for more judicial resources if we know we can be
actually running two
firms. And I've tried to spend time talking to a lot of the attorneys who've been around for a long time and see what has been tried over the years. And partly, I think it's good to get people's ideas so that you don't feel like you're being told what to do all the time and it will work better. But I think they've tried a number of things, and so it seems like docketing should be simple, and it never is as simple as you would think when going in. So,
actually, I think this is the hardest area to docket because mm-hmm. of the statutory timelines mm-hmm. for everything.
Right.
Just so that it's not missed, in the juvenile dependency cases will be prioritized and occur in a timely manner in all stages of the proceeding. Under the third area, which is changes to existing law that will require additional funding, although I don't think a law change is needed, but it will require additional funding, is I believe that the Judicial Department needs to contract with the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges or the National Center for State mm-hmm. Courts to come in and do a court staff staff and judicial officer workload study. Mm-hmm. The last time that was done was more than a dozen years ago mm-hmm. in Oregon, and there have been many, many changes. And I think if we had some real data to yeah. look at what the requirements are, not only with what courts are actually doing, but with what they should be doing with best practices incorporated in that as well, that we could get some new numbers that could help guide local court decisions on where resources are allocated. But, you know, it's going to be expensive, and it's not something that we could do with...
You know, it's funny. I don't know how it happened, but several years ago, I'm going to say 10, but I could be wrong, the governor started appointing family court judges in Multnomah County as family court judges. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't, I, you know, I was very involved at that point, but I have no clue why that happened. But, so it's doable to, you know, maybe play with, the, you know, look, somebody ought to investigate where that comes from.
I think it comes from the local court. I think they tell the governor's office
that they want it.
This is what we need.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it probably does, but mm-hmm. they did it.
Right.
Know? So
this kind of a study, though, can really, really be helpful. I mean, right. they've done it with drug courts and everything to the extent that they tell you that you should spend at least 3.5 minutes per, or so many minutes per participant when you're talking to them and everything. And, it, you know, it's really, really helpful. But
so how much does it cost?
You know, I'd have to check. I know that they just, the National Council just did a big workload study in Washington State. But, you know, I'm thinking it's at least several hundred thousand dollars to get somebody in to do something like that. But
wow.
We wouldn't have. Yeah. I mean, it would require people going and looking and observing and doing courtroom observations and checklist of what is getting done versus what should be getting done, and looking at time logs that judges would keep of what they're doing on the bench as well as off the bench. A lot of the work that happens in juvenile court is work that's done off the bench.
Is that Nancy Miller?
Hmm?
Is that Nancy Miller?
She's no longer with them, but
she did it.
Their organization, the National Council, did that.
Madam Chairman, mm-hmm. can we exercise our personal constitutional rights here pretty soon?
Yeah, let's have a break. Okay, let's take a break. Let's go ahead and take
Thank
a few minutes.
Yes, I need to go feed the meter.
So can we back up for a second? Because
okay.
I want to make sure that we get through one of these all the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, Nancy, you suggested that we have a standards and training recommendation package that was really most of the discussion this morning from the provision of appropriate legal services. Right?
Yep.
And then, so if we do that for the strategies that can be taken under existing law and within current budgetary restraints, but then there were a couple of strategies that were identified under number 3 that would require mm-hmm. additional funding and or changes to existing law.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if we want to take some time to talk about those, since we've already heard earlier that the sooner we get some legislative things in, the better. And
okay, let's do that.
Say again, which one? I'm sorry.
So it was the one, the provision of appropriate legal services in a timely manner.
Got it.
And it was number 3.
Mm-hmm. The first one is another way of stating the attorneys have to be available at shelter care.
So these were strategies submitted by PDSC and the attorneys. And
I think we decided that that one wouldn't necessarily cost anything.
The shelter hearing?
Yeah.
Because we usually come in there.
But it would eliminate the because it's about 50-50 now, isn't it, across the state? About half the judges do and half don't. Is that what we figured when we did this?
Well, I think it's a little more than that.
So it would eliminate the holdouts that aren't appointing.
And I think there would be jurisdictions where you'd have to add lawyers to get there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that it's not necessarily cost. I think it's a mix of cost and not cost. And probably if you didn't have to add lawyers, you'd have to add a judge. It's either on the court docketing side or it's on the lawyer's side.
Mm-hmm.
Or both.
Aren't those the next two packages?
Right.
More lawyers for everybody and more judges and maybe some money for DHS for some stuff?
Well, and I thought we were looking at all of these and then creating separate sort of recommendations. One was standards and training recommendation. This is the way I have noted, but I don't know if this is the way other people were tracking it as well. But I thought one was the standards and training recommendation. I thought another was representation and caseloads, and I thought another one was court docketing.
That's what I have. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Courts and docketing?
Yeah.
Courts and docketing.
Courts and docketing.
Mm-hmm. Courts and docketing. Mm-hmm.
Sort of trying to tie up what we're learning through these separate documents.
Well, what would be, I guess I'd like to hear from everybody what they think this final thing should look like, because we should start thinking about it, if it's going to be a report with recommendations for law changes, then we better get it done, for one thing. But what are we envisioning that this final report should look like? And maybe Bill and Leola can help me with that, because I've never done one of these for the legislature. What's helpful for them? I assume the shorter the better and to the point.
Madam Chair, I think what everything we're talking about here is a means to an end.
Uh-huh.
What's the end?
Right.
And my assumption is that what you want is better results for kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what's the benefit to the state for that?
Mm-hmm.
Fewer contacts with the criminal justice system, fewer contacts with the welfare system, better citizens.
Yeah.
And you know, I think something at the beginning or something that would show what the research shows?
Mm-hmm.
And then moving from there into these means that will get you those results. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
But she's right about the short part, right, Bill?
Well, I always recommend anyone who's talking to the legislature, and we have done a tentative agenda work plan, and we have penciled this in for our December meeting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is the old teaching, Jesuit teaching method. Tell them what you're going to tell them what you told them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the legislative process, do that succinctly. At some point, you may want to think, like what Nancy's doing is for the pilot project, for the other elements. I mean, Nancy's talking about the element of representation. You may want to think about a pilot project that would overlap with hers as it relates to representation for the agencies, for DHS. I've heard a lot of concerns about that, particularly when we're having difficulty in many of our counties and even providing basic services. And the same thing for courts. And then I would suggest thinking about measuring the results.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like the Criminal Justice Commission or the, what's a group out of the University of Oregon?
The Social Science. Mm-hmm. Social.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Social Learning Center.
Yeah.
To measure the results. And then you have something to show better results. And then it, as we go through in time, expand what's good and what works out.
They can do that too, right? The National Council of Family and Juvenile Court Judges, they
sure.
can do a lot of outcome stuff for you.
So I think, Bill, when you raise this concept, the question becomes, do we work together to pick pilot counties where we actually create sort of a model mm-hmm. system where we have infused resources or have created a docketing schedule that really is one that will best serve dependency-involved families. And we have invested resources to make sure that our lawyers have few enough cases that they are available and meeting with their clients and meeting all of their performance standards, and then the state is well represented. Do we tie that all up into pilot counties so that we are essentially creating the perfect model? Or do we pick different jurisdictions and risk losing an opportunity to create that perfect model? And I don't know what other people's thoughts are, but as we move forward with the selection process, it would be very helpful to know if others want to do this as a joint project, which I think we're open to. It would take it away from the Washington State model, but we've already moved away from that. We're including children. We're not just involving parents, and Oregon is different, and we've always prided ourselves on that. So it's just when we're, because we already have some funding and we need to be able to demonstrate to the legislature what we're doing with that funding, if we're going to hold back a little so that we can make this a joint project, I need to be able to articulate that very clearly so it's clear what we're doing. Or we could go ahead and launch with the expectation that other people are going to be joining.
I personally think it should be a joint project. I think that getting agency representation
mm-hmm.
keyed up and getting
enough judges
and judicial resources keyed up for the kinds of changes that we want to be able to implement in these two or one or three counties, I don't know how many, but really supporting that and creating the ideal services and then tracking and measuring what happens to me. So
and it seems to me that you need three because you need a big, medium, and a small.
Well, I don't have money for that.
Mm-hmm.
So
if we delay, we could ask for more money to achieve three counties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a... Sorry.
And we've always said we were willing to participate as long as we could afford it. And that's why we were trying to get a match between the counties where we already have
mm-hmm.
full representation because of circumstance, with what you all are trying to do. But I can't, And that would be, I mean, it would be good to do it all together. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to do that, then I'd have to figure out what we do with our sunsetting law in June of 2015. You know, it might be that that needs to be extended in order to get results out of something like this. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to know the county so I know the volume so I can figure out how to pay for it.
When are we going to know the counties?
Well, I think that what I'm saying is it mm-hmm. sort of depends on how much this is a collaborative project, because I could pick them sooner if it's just me, but I think that if it's all of us, we really, I mean, we've been having conversations,
yeah,
Leola and Lois, we've been meeting and talking and developing statistics so that helps inform our decision. But I do think that if it's a joint project, we need to work together to pick those jurisdictions so that we all have the time and resources to set up the multidisciplinary trainings and do the kind of work that we need to do to help move each of our constituent groups in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer to when will we know our pilot counties may depend heavily upon whether this is a joint project or something that we're going to continue to run more independently.
It also probably depends on if you're going to pick for your pilots the counties that are the furthest from the ideal or the closest.
Right, and I can say that we need counties where we have some lawyers who are already engaged and are well on their way to understanding, if not in implementing best practices, because we have contracts that exist around the state for this biennium, and we need to work within the constraints of those.
Yeah.
So we can add lawyers, but we really need every lawyer in the jurisdiction we pick to be involved, because we won't get the kinds of results we want if some of the lawyers still have enormous caseloads. It just won't work. They will be the holdup in terms of getting things moving.
If it isn't a joint project, too, I've seen these things where you put a whole bunch of resources in, but you actually end up fighting guerrilla war with the people that don't have the other things. That isn't going to work.
Right. And I think Lois and Leo have been very gracious in their support, their willingness to support us as we move through this process, you know, in terms of helping avoid some of that. But I do think if it's a joint endeavor, mm-hmm. everyone is invested at a different level.
Right.
Well, it seems to me there's a good argument for the legislature, because these things have sort of come together from different mm-hmm. angles, but they're all sort of converging, the whole representation issue. And we're all going to be back at the legislature with something around that, and it seems to me they would want us to come sort of with a common voice, and they're not just solving mm-hmm. different issues without knowing mm-hmm. the influence that will have on the other issues that are in front of them.
And I guess the thing I've been kind of struggling with is you could put together the best system in the world in terms of all of this, and it comes to a screeching halt if you don't have drug treatment, housing, you know, all the things that you want, that you need for these people to get where they need to go to.
Yeah, I'm quite certain that the court process is smoother when everyone's represented with competent counsel. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the case moves faster.
Right.
Services and access make cases move, I think, equally to what mm-hmm. the court system does. But we have that. In May, we will have the enhanced service array in every county. Not every county will have every service.
And if you had services on a certain level, there would be a lot less court process. So
we'll look for the transfer of those savings to the court system into the service room.
Okay, so how do we want to do this? Are we comfortable those are the three areas we want to look at? Standards and training, representation, and front end
courts
stuff,
and
then courts and docketing.
And what about, just for safety's sake, Madam Chairman, mm-hmm. other, you know, sort of a miscellaneous in case we overlook something.
Yeah. The rest of the story.
Know, yeah, if there's anything else hanging out there that we need to bring in.
Well, we haven't actually talked about access to CASAs.
Yeah.
And how we'll ensure that also happens.
Well, it's an interesting question in terms of the project, the what are we calling it? The pilot. Yeah, the pilot in CASA, for instance. Mm-hmm. is there a an element in that planning about CASA and where it fits in and whether there should be some, you know, input in terms of that? I mean, that would be cool.
It would, and it's funny because, of course, Washington, they use Guardians Ad Litem, which is a different system, and we hadn't contemplated yet how to include CASA, but I think that's a very good question and certainly appropriate, especially if we're moving in this direction where it's mm-hmm. a really a very multidisciplinary effort.
Good way to answer some of your questions, too, I suspect, right? Just to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want us to parcel these out? Maybe a couple of people take each one and come up pretty quickly with what are the elements from all of this? You still just pull it together.
I think that would be really helpful. And our next meeting is in a month. But if we could have that done in a month, then we could be ready to actually have something to put together.
So I'm going to ask one more question, and this may be just taking us in a completely ridiculous direction. But it occurs to me that when the piece that may be missing, and maybe if we include that front end management, mm-hmm. that's a piece of it. But I think that actually fits under this broader mm-hmm. umbrella, which is sort of system management. When should each thing be happening? When should discovery be provided?
Mm-hmm.
When should hearings typically be set? You know, that the practice of, I mean, it fits a little within the docketing conversation too, but there's this, all of our systems are interacting together, and we're not, so far in what we've discussed, we don't have a category that would cover what the timing of different practices should be. So sharing of discovery, court hearings.
What about best practices sort of update?
System best practices kind of thing?
So there's best practices and there's...
good enough practice.
Well, no, there's processes. I mean, practices are like a standard, but the processes and how the different... So it's like a process improvement mapping of the juvenile court process and what makes, how do you get to the best practice from looking at the mapping of the juvenile court process?
Right.
That's kind of what we did here.
But putting that into a more linear, you know,
right. Well, so
there
for
is
instance,
there's a removal, there's a petition, there's discovery, you know, when do these, go ahead.
We're implementing differential response. And so one of the things in those counties where we're first doing it is we sent someone in to look at the processes the branch has to achieve certain outcomes mm-hmm. and how do those need to be adjusted when they start using the alternate track to ensure that they don't lose the efficiency of what all has to happen. Regardless of what track you go through. So your processes change every time you tweak your system or add a person or change your IT system because now it requires you to do things differently. And so looking at a court process, and maybe that's done if we're doing it in a joint pilot, maybe it's done in the jurisdiction where we're doing the pilot.
Right.
Because you're going to have a different involvement of all the parties in that place, so maybe you need to go through and do a process improvement on the court process.
Right, but though we are walking in with some assumptions, and we need to be able to share those assumptions with, I think, a pilot county. Like, we want this pilot county to be a county where discovery is shared in advance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the, I'm articulating these things to my groups, but if we had something documented, it would be really helpful.
You know, if you had, like, when you started mentioning this idea, I think of the various flowcharts we have for the life of a case and
mm-hmm.
where you splinter why off. Yeah. So if you had
the Tim Travis
each
legacy.
Kind of stage or event, who's got what responsibilities
right.
to do what? So it's really mm-hmm. concrete. And so it's this life of this child's case. How does it move along and who does what when?
Mm-hmm.
Like where are all the moving pieces?
It occurs to me, too, that, you know, there's, in our county anyway, we've had a real change in the last couple of years in that we're starting to use, you know, I would say 5 years ago, the number of cases we had where we took legal only was minimal. You know, it just didn't happen. If we went in, we were going in and the kids were being removed. And now that's not true. Mm-hmm. We've got a large number of them where we took legal and we got attorneys involved and we had a hearing and they're coming to court, but we didn't remove the kids. And that's a real culture change in how you work those cases and the outcome. And it would be interesting to see if we're getting better outcomes doing that. I don't know. But so there's a lot of things going on in different places. I think in the last few years there's been a lot of changes that have happened pretty fast, and we haven't kept a good handle on how that's.
And that may be something where a sort of a national juvenile and family court judges contract could help document some of that stuff. Or I don't know if OJD, if JSEP has internal resources, or, you know, if we have resources we could dedicate. You know, if that could be a group project, but it seems to me like that kind of mapping project, it's helpful to have someone who has that task to bring together all the ideas into one document.
So maybe number four is process improvement and best practices.
Mm-hmm.
Systems. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got three areas here, four areas then, so at least than I've got. And maybe five if we end up with just kind of a holdover group. Just in case. So that would be five. Leola, you put these together. How can we...
I only did the ones that... We did somebody else to the
other one. I know, but the original format and everything mm-hmm. here of using these, how do you think that could work to get these into this area? Should we keep these goals and then put them within each one of these?
My gut says no.
Uh-huh.
My gut says we look at all of the things that people, that the various entities said that they could commit to,
mm-hmm.
and... So the standards and training group would then go through and look at each of these
and
pull out things that are related to standards and training.
Okay. Right.
And the representation group would do the same thing.
All right. Okay, that makes sense to me. I can wrap my head around that better. Mm-hmm. All right, so do we want to have four groups or five? Do we want to have or just have each of the four groups, if you don't have it, if it doesn't fit in yours but you think it's important, put it in a separate list so that we don't lose it. And so we need, who wants to do standards and training? That should be...
Nancy said she was...
Well, you know, it's hard because I'm actually looking at it thinking, I really, representation in caseloads
is
so critical from where I sit. But standards and training is as well. I would be happy to participate in both. I don't know that I could lead both.
I'll participate in the standards and training as well.
Okay, so, Lois, and then you want to do the representation, Nancy.
And I'd like to be on that one.
What?
The caseloads and representation.
Okay, so then it would be Lori.
Joanne.
Oh, Joanne, excuse me.
I'll take on the courts and docketing.
Okay.
Say that louder.
She's doing courts and docketing. Okay.
I'll work with you on that.
Thank you.
Okay.
I can do the not by myself, though.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking at Leola. Mm-hmm. The process improvement and best practice mapping.
Okay. And that is who? Is that Melanie?
Megan.
Okay.
Standards and training. Did somebody take a lead on that yet? I'm not volunteering.
I think you just did.
Oh, no.
Thank you.
Did that come out of my mouth?
Thank you.
All right, so...
You'll hear from me a lot.
So we've got Lois and...
Lois, Nancy, and Megan...
Lene. Mm-hmm. I know we're matching close today, but
makes it harder.
And both of our classes.
Okay, and then representation, we've got Nancy, Joanne, that's improved front end. That may be enough. And then we've got courts and docketing, Leola, Valerie, and then process mapping. I'll join Megan on that one.
I think I would like to, too, mm-hmm. just because, and I'll work with Angela. She might want to help with some of this, too.
On process or on representation?
I'll talk with, since she's not here, I'm sure she'll take over something that I've signed up for.
Okay.
And I will let everyone know what that is.
Okay.
I'd be happy to help with the process improvement.
Okay.
Or the process mapping.
Okay. And then, so if we designate, our next meeting is the 11th, I think it's exactly in a month. Is that right? I can get my, yeah, the 11th. Do we want to,
it's hot.
Oh, no,
it's
so
the 9th.
The 9th, May 9th.
Okay.
And it's going to be hard for some of these groups to, because people are spread out and it's hard to do it over the phone and things like that, and they're not going to be able to get together. How would you like to work on the task here so we're real clear? Is we're going to take these things and go through and put them within each category. So maybe what if everybody in each one would do that and then have it for the meeting on the 11th. Can I leave everybody to organize themselves so that
mm-hmm.
and should we set a for the written materials, have them when
a week in advance,
so by
the second
by May 2nd. Have something in writing so we can pass it out to the group, and then we'll have another work session.
Okay.
Does that sound like a plan for everybody?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And what I'm going to need to do, that I think, do we still have that flow chart? Remember, we used to have like tons mm-hmm. and tons of them mm-hmm. that were all printed out. If you haven't seen that, we should probably, for this process mapping group, we should probably get that.
We can email it to
everybody.
Folks.
And I've got like tons of them. They were in a really nice printed thing, but I still use it all the time. And that would be a really good way of taking that thing and trying to. So it may look kind of funny, but that would be the way to do this, I think. Would be
identify all those points in
those
time.
Points where there's barriers or problems. Okay. And I think the one that's gonna and then I guess the other thing to think about as you're putting this together is to try to highlight or identify where there we need a legislative response or a legal response or a law change, because that's what we've got to get put together and come out of the next meeting. I guess the goal would be to have that put together so that we can get it to where it needs to go if we're going to be asking for law changes.
Maybe one of the things I should do as part of our pilot is bring together the people who you know, we've already set up some systems or some partner meetings, and I could include CASA too, but to move forward with creating a pilot concept that includes everyone, we can move. That way I have something to share with legislators and others to demonstrate the direction that we're heading in.
Yeah. I think
the advantage of a pilot, I would think, and again, Bill can tell me too, is that it's a lot more concrete than the legislators can look at it and see, rather than, you know, just explaining something. You can say, well, this is what we did and this is what happened. And I think that's just human nature. It's a lot easier to see it.
I'm not on anything. I think I probably should be on representation on caseloads.
Okay.
Do you, Nancy? You really want to be on three committees?
pick your favorite. I would think I could see you on any number of these. So pick the one you like best.
Okay. Anything else, or we've got our marching orders here?
Bill, I have a question for you. Did you want to participate, too, in this pilot discussion as we develop the concept? Or is this something?
Keep me informed if you think I should be at a meeting. I will be.
Okay, thank you.
I have to take 5 or 6 weeks off before the end of the year, or I lose time, and I'm not going to get the time back. So, you know. In fact, I will not be here in July because I'm going to a wedding back east where my family's from. So.
Okay. So I will work with you to keep you apprised.
You and I have worked together for a long time.
Yep.
And Judge, if I could comment on a pilot project, I mean, what we are probably going to be doing is asking the legislature. I hate to see bills go from Judiciary Committee that I spent a lot of time on and go to Ways and Means Committee to die.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be asking them to expend money. As you know, there are lots of requests for expansion for people to. The proposals to spend money. You have certain members who have invested a lot of time in these issues, Representative Krieger being one of them. I remember when he worked with then Judge Brewer on adequate appellate counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from that investment we've seen very favorable results. I can remember sitting in the rooms 20 years ago with judges that work in this area, and I not only thought they were from different states, I thought they were from different legal systems. And that's managed to create uniformity. More likely that people are now following the law than they used to. When you bring a pilot project to them, you're asking for small investment.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature back in 2003 did something that no other state did. I was involved in it. And that was, we created in the criminal justice area a requirement that programs be evidence-based.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's helped change the culture in the state. This is a follow-up on that. You definitely want to put some component in there, someone to research the results.
Yeah.
My assumption, I mean, one of the... The best arguments we have had in the legislature in the last 10 years for putting money into this area is a Washington State study. There's a benefit for the state. Everyone wants to do right by kids, but there's also a benefit for the state in the sense that you are helping to have better citizens.
So we need to bring an evaluator into this right now, somebody that might be interested in.
It would help someone who could tell you how you would structure a pilot program. I mean, maybe you need to go out to someone who would probably want to collect statistics now from those counties so they have a benchmark to start off with. And then,
I'm thinking you of all that, but then I don't know.
Social learning center?
Yeah. I was just wondering, the outfit in Washington that's doing Washington's has done some work in the guardianship area also. They do really good work. I wonder if that's, I mean, I'm not
the junior, were they not? Was that the...
No, it's
the original study.
Washington.
Nancy, do you remember that? I think Waynesburg, Virginia?
There were two studies. One was done locally in Washington, and the other one was from out of state, and I...
Washington State Policy Institute.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just thinking the same.
Washington State Policy Institute. I actually wrote a bill one time, helped put a bill together that would have created that in Oregon. And I went to Washington to find the statute. I couldn't find it. It was a budget note. And what they basically do is they contract, well, they have an arrangement with Evergreen State University. They have 1.5 people, but what they do is they contract with researchers from the universities to do the research. And I have been down the Social Learning Center with now Justice Brewer, and Kip Leonard, who used to be the juvenile judge in Lane County, he's very active with them too. So he may be, both of them may be. And Mike Livingston too is another person familiar with what they do.
Well, I'm going to be in Eugene for that CRB.
You're on their board, right? Are you on their board?
I was on the board of an offshoot of that we closed down last year. But the superintendent is on the board of the new one, and Kip is on the board of the new one.
Okay. I'm going to be in Eugene for that CRB thing at the on the 1st. I wonder if it would be possible to set up a meeting with those folks.
In the morning?
Do you already have an evaluator, Nancy, that you're contemplating?
I mean, all these people have passed our radar, but we have not engaged the services of anyone.
I bet you they would.
There may also be people at Portland State with the masters in...
Because Portland State did ours for the drug court, so they're the ones that I've used, and they were able to...
And the discussion paper for the Washington one was done by the Partners for Our Children from UW, University of Washington.
Oh, that's right.
Craig Prince for the Criminal Justice Commission would be a good resource, too.
Yep.
Nancy, you know him well. So.
I do.
Does somebody want to take the lead on, I mean, it sounds like you kind of already have, but it sounds like we need to start really thinking about that and seeing if somebody's interested in joining with us on this.
Right, and I need to have some conversations with legislators and our LFO analysts if we're kind of changing directions to make sure that it's something that they feel supportive of. I don't want to lose an opportunity, and I suspect they would be supportive, but I need to have those conversations. And I would be happy to take a leadership role in helping identify a research entity, but I think for me step one is having those conversations, assuming this group has made a decision that that is the direction we want to move in.
And what was that?
We would participate.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, just keep in mind, I will be around in Eugene on the 1st. So for that, so if there's some meetings or something, then let me know.
You know, one of the other benefits of at least just talking to one or more entities that would be interested in evaluation is you'll get a picture of how much the evaluation would cost.
Because
it's not cheap. And you may be in a process where you can't just go out and pick the one you want. You may have to offer people the opportunity to bid on it.
And it may help you pick your pilot county, too, because if it's way cheaper to do Lane County, for example, because that's where your evaluator is, then maybe that's the way to go.
Not doing Lane County. Because they're a DR implementer, early implementer, and that will just get...
Right. We've already committed to no differential response county.
So no Lake Klamath or Lane, please.
But it's one of the reasons nobody ever wants to do a pilot with us, because it's so expensive.
Far away.
Yeah, too far away, you know. But you never know.
Well, we'd have to certainly have a friendly judicial area to do it. I mean, it's got to be a judge who's willing to.
And I've had conversations with several judges in the size of counties that I think we're looking at, and people have been very receptive.
Good. But did they know we were talking about docketing and process flow? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And one of the counties is even a county that is not currently doing appointing counsel in shelter. And it was made very clear that this would be a requirement.
And again, you might want to pick one that has already implemented Odyssey so that you're not dealing with that problem, too.
That's a good point.
Because the counties that are doing that, it takes over your life. And
Right. Right, as long as we can get the data out. Yeah. I mean, the hard thing about those counties is there's been sort of a blackout for data, and I don't mean to suggest that that's going to be the case carrying on. I just mean that it makes it hard to
know where we're at. That's implementing right now, for example. If you're going to do one, you will maybe want one that's an old Odyssey County, one of the first ones.
And we do have two of our performance measure reports drafted for the Odyssey counties, and those are being vetted and examined closely by staff in those counties to make sure that the reports are accurate. So we're getting there. We hope to have them rolled out for our judges at the conference this summer, and we're building on.
Yeah, because we're supposed to be all done with Odyssey by the end of 2016, right? Okay. Anything else for the good of the order? We will adjourn then.
Thank you.
We will adjourn then.
Thank you.